This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The United Auto Workers strike against GM continues. It's complicated by corruption investigations into the UAW's top leaders. Strikes like these are nearly impossible to avoid as the balance of power between labor and industry maneuvers back and forth. But the idea of some kind of equity between labor and industry is actually a fairly recent phenomenon. A major UAW strike in 1945 was the start of that change. That strike also resulted in the rise of one Walter Reuther, who would become a major voice in the labor movement and civil rights movement. Here's Reuther in a 1958 television interview with Mike Wallace on ABC.
All right, Walter Reuther, what is Reutherism?
Well, I'm not sure what Reutherism is, but I can tell you what I believe. I believe, to begin with, that free labor and free management have a great deal more in common than they have in conflict. And I believe that freedom is an indivisible value, that you can't have free labor without free management, and that we both need to learn to work and cooperate together to preserve our free society in a free world.
I recently talked to Elizabeth Pfau. She's the chair of the history department at Wayne State University. I asked her about the significance of the 1945 strike wave. Here's our conversation. So let's talk about this wave of strikes across the nation that you talked about. This strike that we're talking about that started in November is against GM. How many union members went out?
320,000.
That's a huge amount of people. That's the largest strike in the United States at that point. What was the impact of how that strike went on the rest of the country and the other unions?
Well, it's curious because I would almost argue the other way around, that there's a strike wave that happens, and right prior to the UAW going out on strike, the United Electrical Workers goes out on strike against General Electric. And a couple weeks after the UAW, actually a few days after the UAW goes out on strike, the steelworkers go out on strike. And the steelworkers are actually a larger group. And those two unions are the same kind of unions as the UAW. Especially the UE has a history of a lot of internal conflict, but also of being a fairly democratic union. The steelworkers doesn't have that reputation, very top-down, but they're CIO. And their industry, the steel industry, really is kind of like it produces the base commodity for many other industries, including most significantly auto. So those two groups going out on strike are going to have a relationship to what the UAW is doing. So the UAW comes out under Reuther with this idea of, we want a 30% raise that will catch us up to where we were during the war. We want we don't want GM to raise prices. We want to have some say about this. And if you can't give us a 30% raise, we want to look at the books. This is again, unheard of. It's considered outrageous, but is also, again, in line with his vision of a more democratic economy. The unions around them are, on the one hand, seeing this as very bold leadership, but I think especially the steelworkers, it's about money. It's about benefits. It's not about governing industry. And their union had been created in such a top-down fashion. I don't think that there's the same kind of push. And the electrical workers and the steelworkers settle first. And they settle first, and what they settle for is a 17.5% raise. At the time when UAW is arguing for a lot more than that, but also arguing for these structural changes. And quite frankly, as soon as they settle, they've kind of closed down the ability of the UAW to continue to insist on what are considered outside the box, extraordinary demands.
It's precedent set.
Yes. And the only thing that I think that sort of comes out of it the UAW gets two things that are really important. And they get a permanent dues checkoff. During the war, it was temporary and tied to those agreements. They also get an affirmation from GM and later Ford and Chrysler, of respecting seniority in promotion and transfers. And seniority, again, in 45, is a really charged issue because you have all these men who have been gone overseas. Should there be veterans' preference? If veterans return back, exactly where do they fit in this hierarchy? Who gets to keep their jobs in a time of layoffs? Seniority is a major concession. And again, companies might have preferred to do it differently, but this to them is not as important as keep your hands off of our price discussions, keep your hands off of our books. And eventually what happens is that the Truman administration, they basically want the UAW to settle, and the UAW eventually winds up settling.
There were a number of strikes of auto workers before this 1945 strike, which started in November. But why was this UAW strike more significant than the previous ones?
Each major strike, there's usually a context, a political, economic context, that can explain its significance. There's a lot of people who would argue that it's World War II itself, that there's such demand for defense production and such a huge need for labor. I mean, if you think about 16 million people go into the armed forces, almost all of them men, but some women, and those people, many of them are factory workers. How are you going to replace them? And moreover, how are you going to recruit new workers to produce new things? So it's literally a situation in which labor should have absolute control. But there's also the war.
Right. And during that time, they had this no strike pledge, because that would be unpatriotic, right? Everything for the war effort. It basically eliminated workers' leverage, suppressed their labor demands. So how did that affect UAW prior to the end of the war?
Well, the interesting thing is that the labor gives in the sense of holding down strike conflict. There's not an absence of strikes. There are some wildcat strikes, but labor leadership vows no strikes. And so for the most part, there are none. What they get in return is something called the dues checkoff. And that dues checkoff means that instead of having to recruit every single worker, the job is a union job and whoever steps into it is a union member. So the second thing that they get is this presumption that the contracts will remain steady. And the third piece of it is that the government guarantees what's called cost plus to all manufacturers, which means that they will pay for building your factories, they'll pay for additional workers, they'll pay for everything, plus they will guarantee you a certain level of profits. So the question in 1945 is, now that the war is winding down, now that we don't need millions of tanks and guns and airplanes.
Sure, everybody's retooling.
Everybody's retooling. How are we going to convert back to peacetime production? But also, what are the levels of employment going to be? And furthermore, there's a lot of discussion through the 30s into the 40s about within more conservative circles, and those conservative circles include corporate heads, about whether they're going to continue to cooperate. Would the end of the war, this unemployment that will follow, and the fears of a Great Depression allow them to push back against unions? In the union side, the question is, are we going to be able to maintain these relationships, or are we going to be faced with this new offensive, employers basically saying, we will not sign another contract with you? And Phil Murray, who's head of the CIO, talks about that the consequence will be a massive strike wave.
We should explain the CIO was the Congress of Industrial Organizations. The UAW was one part of the CIO, to make that clear.
Yes.
So tell me about that relationship between what's happening in Detroit with the UAW and this larger organization, the CIO, and how they were viewing this period as of transition.
I think what they don't understand, and I think comes clear in this massive strike wave, is how eager workers were to strike. That the fear of depression, of returning, of high unemployment, is less important to the ordinary worker than the fact that they feel that for 4 years they have towed the line, they have done their patriotic duty, they have worked long hours. The only way that they got these high wages was overtime, and they're faced with threats of inflation and with what they perceive to be employer hostility. And so what you find in 45, and it happens in, you see it in Detroit, but you see it across the country in the more than 100 UAW locals and throughout the steel industry, mining, the electrical industry. I mean, far beyond that is workers chomping at the bit to strike.
So in steps a guy who later would become a legendary union leader, Walter Reuther. And he sees the sentiment of his membership of his union. And basically, I'm wondering how his actions change the path of what it means to be a union.
Reuther and his brothers were really fundamental to the original organizing. But in 45, he's not the leader. He's a unit director. And he becomes president by the end of the strike. I mean, by the end of the strike, it's laid down. He's elected president of the UAW at the end. What Reuther has, and he demonstrates this actually early in the war, is a vision about this kind of tripartite governance between employers or business, labor, and government, that they will work it out, and that he would like labor to be an equal player at the table. So early on, he proposes an absolutely fantastic idea that, I mean, fantabulous in some ways. No one believed it could come true, which is that we should be on track to produce 500 planes a day. And people think he's stark raving mad. I mean, there's certain people who do. But in business itself, business leaders don't want to see this kind of leadership. And what's ironic about that is that by the end of the war, we are producing 500 planes a day, that exactly what he envisioned would happen. And a lot of the agreements during the war are precisely that kind of tripartite agreement between business, labor, and government about how to produce the needed goods for the war. At the end of the war, Reuther has been thinking about what he comes to call the democratization of industry, that labor shouldn't just be there in the crisis times, but that labor should be at the table and actually have input into pricing, into production, into automation. And in part, it's because he sees on the far horizon that machines could very well start replacing workers. In part, it's because he sees that he perceives that employers will always use the threat of job blackmail to keep workers in line. But I also think he's thinking about a more democratic economy in which workers would have a bigger say, a bigger political say, and would not be drowned out in national councils.
What was the response of corporate America? I mean, did they see labor as simply another commodity, or did they see some value in this kind of cooperation?
I think there probably were corporate heads who start out as anti-union and who become pro-union. I think this is a minority opinion. I think most employers see that the most flexible cost is not going to be natural resources. It's not going to be management, which is sometimes looks pricey, but is a relatively small part of the cost. The most flexible cost is labor. And so they're always the factor that they're trying to find out how much do we have to pay in order to have a labor force? How much can we afford to give, and how will that affect these other things, such as our prices, our relationship with our stockholders, our relationship with government, our relationship with the public? And so there are some that are positively antagonistic, and you saw that in a couple of these strikes. And a lot of it, it's they don't want to give labor more than they have to, But they're only sort of like negotiating because it's some kind of labor peace is necessary. They just don't see labor as an equal partner.
74 years ago, right? Yeah. And here we are today. Union membership is down after unions became the thing we kind of took for granted. It's down in the private sector. I think it's safe to say the rights that coal miners and auto workers and USWA workers and garment makers fought for in the 20th century are taken for granted. We expect a 40-hour work week. We expect all these safety things to be put in place. Now some workers think that unions are past their usefulness. They make the U.S. Industry a little less competitive. We've got right-to-work states like Michigan now. What's your take on the shift in the public attitudes from 1945 and 1946 to today?
The public actually supports unions much more now than they did 5 years ago, than they did 10 years ago. There has been an increase in public support. Some of it has to do with the very aggressiveness with which unions have been attacked. I think that's probably less important than the fact that we now have an economy in which there are more low-wage jobs than there are well-paid jobs.
So you're saying the pendulum is starting to swing back the other way.
The pendulum has, and I think you would note from the wave of strikes that have happened in teaching, in nursing, and among public workers, even in private industry, there has been a resurgence of labor militancy. And it may be that by pushing right to work in 2012, 2014, the anti-union forces kind of overplayed their hand, that there is a sense that unions might actually offer a different alternative, greater protection. And I also have to note that a lot of the things that used to protect workers that were not union, such as the OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, are vastly underfunded. So we have horrific occupational accidents that OSHA can do very little to address. And so unions can become a way in which you can make demands that are not just about wages and not just about benefits, but like in the case of education or sometimes about public funding of schools and about the presence of librarians and social workers and trying to get schools repaired. In the case of nurses, can be about patient-nurse ratios that protect patient safety. And so that the stuff that's coming out of the unions actually is very reminiscent of the 30s when it was no longer how much money we can get out of people, but what are the broader issues of working conditions and workers' lives that unions can help address.
Elizabeth Pfau, she's the chair of the history department at Wayne State University.